The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Intense Fight for New OR Beds. Big and small healthcare providers in the Triangle are jousting to score approval from state regulators to add new operating beds. At stake, millions of dollars in profits and a chance to capture a bigger piece of a growing healthcare services pie. The cover story actually begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with a second headline, All-Out Battle for Beds, Big Dollars. And this article is written by Seth Thomas Gullidge. On a sunny Friday morning in October, a dialysis patient, a Chamber of Commerce president, and dozens of lawyers walked into a sparsely fitted conference room on the Dorothea Dix campus. The Triangle's largest healthcare providers, UNC Healthcare, Duke University Health, and Wake Med Health and Hospitals, were represented by the dark suits ready to ask for permission from state regulators to expand in Wake County. It was one of hundreds of steps in a healthcare organization's path to do what would otherwise come naturally to it, expand. Hours of presentations followed, each blending into the other as presenters made eerily similar pitches, referring to thousands of pages of documents containing hundreds of graphics, figures, arguments, and spreadsheets. The process is called Certificate of Need. Interspersed in the tangle of legalese and growth projections were pleas from people, such as Chatty Harris, a dialysis patient, seeking quicker access to care. In 6 years, I've gathered 2 infections, she told the room. As a dialysis patient, I don't think we should have to wait that long. This is about our lives. Whatever it takes to help us get on with our lives and save money, that's what we want to do. Harris's plea has not yet been answered. That comes January 29, when just 2 signatures from North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services officials will conclude a historic fight between the Triangle's major healthcare providers by announcing the approved distribution of 6 operating rooms. The coming decisions have the power to transform a swath of land, bring healthcare closer to thousands of residents, and let the winning organization rake in millions of dollars. It is also a step that could lessen wait times in overloaded hospitals, decrease health costs for outpatient procedures, and bring medical locations to budding cities and neighborhoods in the Triangle. It also has the power to prevent an organization from doing anything. In past years, hospitals have often looked to add patients and market share with major additions within their established footprints. For example, UNC Rex opened the 8-story North Carolina Heart and Vascular Hospital in 2017, and Duke announced a $100 million expansion plan for Duke Regional last year. But many of these new pitches are seeking new beds in the parts of the Triangle growing at lightning speed, and often a long way from the established medical centers. It's no surprise 4 of the proposals seek beds in Cary, a healthcare market that is underserved, and with a highly affluent population promising years of revenue streams. For the larger healthcare providers in the Triangle, the CON applications is as close to a gloves-come-off process one could imagine, because millions of dollars are at stake. For the first time in years, all of the Triangle's major players are taking off their gloves in the same ring. Why are they fighting? North Carolina, like a majority of states in the country, adheres to a CON process, which puts the power of when and where providers can expand services in the hands of NCDHHS. Those regulations bring hordes of lawyers employed to prove with meticulous attention to detail and state regulation, manifesting in endless pages of applications, that their provider is more worthy than the other providers of expanding their service. Traditionally, these hordes have spent most of their time fighting bureaucratic red tape, not each other. Recent state decisions on these applications have been routine. Last year, in Wake, Orange, or Durham counties, only 1 denial was issued when UNC Rex and Duke Raleigh fought to acquire a PET CAT scanner, and Duke won. Of the nearly 1,500 decisions across the state the department has issued since 2012 that Triangle Business Journal reviewed, only 152 were denials. Of those, fewer were in Triangle counties, and even fewer were the result of competition between major providers. That's not the case now. Between the bidding providers, 9 projects, including the construction of 7 ambulatory surgical centers, are proposed, totaling nearly $100 million. Most of them will not be approved. The unprecedented competition spawned from the 2018 State Medical Facilities Plan. That plan estimated Wake County will need 6 more operating rooms by 2020, meaning one provider or a combination of providers will be allowed to construct 6 more. The deficit, calculated by the number of necessary rooms to meet projected volume, is a result of both the burgeoning Wake County population and the increased surgical demand from other counties. State officials project that by 2020, Duke Raleigh Hospital is projected to have a 6.7 operating room deficit, and WakeMed Raleigh will have a 3.4 OR deficit. But the state separately notes the deficits by the organization's total bed space in the county, meaning WakeMed as a whole is projected to have a 2.7 OR surplus in 2020. The same is true of UNC Rex Hospital, which reports a 3.9 OR deficit, even though UNC Healthcare reports a 2 OR surplus. To address these growing demands, the providers focus on ambulatory surgical centers, referred to as ASCs in the industry. The surgical centers provide same-day outpatient surgeries for patients for less serious medical needs, ideally saving patients and providers money while also clearing the surgery rooms at the hospitals for more serious inpatient cases. For example, Duke's request states, "Because ASCs are highly specialized and function on a much smaller scale, they are able to provide services at a lower price than a full-service hospital." Steve Lawler, president of the North Carolina Healthcare Association, says the need for outpatient centers is growing. "More than half of hospital services are now delivered on an outpatient basis, driven by advances in care, by payers, and by consumers," he says. "Hospitals and health systems are challenged to expand outpatient services and make them convenient and accessible, while continuing to provide essential health services for their communities." Lawler also mentions health providers generally support the arduous CON process, calling it an important framework that is supported by the association's members. The CON proposals include Duke University Health. Duke is proposing to build a $34.3 million surgical center as part of a larger medical campus in Western Cary. The center would contain 4 operating rooms, marking it as both the most expensive of the competing requests and the only one that asked for more than 2 rooms. Duke is also proposing to build 2 additional operating rooms at Duke Raleigh Hospital. The surgical center is to be complete by July 2012. The 2 ORs at Duke Raleigh would be set for December of this year. And that may be a typo. They may have meant 2021. UNC Healthcare. UNC is proposing to develop a center in Cary with 2 operating rooms totaling $16.6 million, as well as a similar center in Garner totaling $16.2 million. UNC Rex is also applying for 2 additional operating rooms on site. The proposed projects would be complete by July 2021. WakeMed Health and Hospitals. WakeMed is proposing to build a center in North Raleigh with 2 operating rooms, totaling $11.3 million. It also proposes building a similar center in Cary, totaling $8.6 million. Both projects would be complete by October 2020. RAC Surgery. Its proposal is for a Raleigh center with a single operating room focused on vascular access procedures for patients with end-stage renal disease. The project is projected to cost $2 million and be complete by January 2020. And OrthoNC, the group of orthopedic clinics, is proposing a single operating room in Raleigh focused on orthopedic and pain management procedures. The project is expected to cost $3.9 million and would be complete in October 2020. Altogether, the applications represent requests for 16 separate operating rooms, far more than the 6 rooms regulators are expected to approve. Millions of dollars at stake. The providers that receive approval for their projects get exclusive permission to build operating rooms. According to their applications, providers estimate that within the third year following their project's completion, between 1,600 and 4,000 cases could be revolving through the proposed centers annually. That number fluctuates depending on the project, but the dollars are big. Duke's project, the most ambitious of the six surgical center projects, estimates by the third year it will see 4,770 cases annually, charging $9,430 on average per case for a total of $15.9 million in gross revenue, according to their CON application. In-hospital operating rooms, however, show a much higher cost to patients, averaging at $35,521 per case for the proposed project, as opposed to $8,302 for the proposed ambulatory centers. While the scope of the decisions on who wins the centers is significant, the decisions are made by a small group of state employees who follow criteria outlined in state law. The law requires applicants demonstrate the need for the project, and it has particular requirements such as the demonstration of the effect on access for low-income people, minorities, handicapped, and the elderly. The applications and comments are considered by a project analyst employed by the state and assigned to certain counties. After considering those applications, the analyst and a manager working alongside as co-signer issue the decision. Mike McKillop is overseeing the Wake County decision, and Fatima Wilson is the team leader assigned to McKillop's area. Details about them and their processes are guarded. NCDHHS officials have refused to arrange interviews with the analysts or managers involved, although McKillop and other DHHS staffers have answered basic questions about the process via email. A public records request to the DHHS General Counsel Office requesting more details about these analysts was denied, though their start dates with the department were provided. When the decisions are issued, applicants have 30 days to appeal before the CON is issued, and then applicants can present their arguments to an administrative law judge. The majority of decisions are not contested, with few applications even competitive. That's not expected to happen this time. Competition has an impact on lives. The competition rages beyond Wake County. Duke and UNC Rex are competing for six OR spaces in Orange County, while Duke Health and South Point Surgery Center are competing for four OR spaces in Durham County. And the 2019 State Medical Facilities Plan projects a deficit of another three operating rooms in Orange County and a two OR deficit in Wake County. Applications for those spots are due in April and August. The winners get more health care and jobs. Neil Padgett, president of the Garner Chamber of Commerce, said at the hearing that UNC Rex's Garner project will help us as we recruit more businesses to Garner that will, in turn, improve our local economy and quality of life for our residents. I urge you to support the Garner community and approve the Garner project with Rex Healthcare, he said. Harris, who has been on dialysis for 13 years, is a patient of Raleigh Dialysis and president of its patient support group. She spoke in support for RAC Surgery Center at the hearing, saying it would increase access to dialysis patients who often need outpatient surgeries to prevent infections. Harris said she and other patients would often have to wait weeks, even months, for their procedures. It would be great to have something like this to be able to go to maybe the next day, maybe that Friday, maybe even the next Monday, she said. For a patient, it's about our lives. It's about our health. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. An office space with a lease rate of $40? Yep, in RTP. Commercial real estate leases have been shooting upward in recent years, with leases in desirable locations in the downtowns of Raleigh and Durham stretching beyond $30 per square foot. That's raised the question of when the Triangle will see rents of $40 per square foot. Well, some space at the 400 Frontier site in Research Triangle Park is now listed with Cushman & Wakefield for just that, $40 per square foot. But Biz hears the reason for that is the spot is pre-built lab space designed for a startup. So the idea is a young company can walk in, plug in, and get going. So it's not quite the same as a normal lease. But still, $40 a square foot suddenly doesn't seem so unrealistic in the Triangle. As Folt exits, UNC Chapel Hill says, "Brother, could you spare a billion?" The development office at UNC Chapel Hill is urging supporters to remain loyal despite the stunning resignation of Chancellor Carol Folt and the quick move by the UNC System Board of Governors to shove her out early. Folt planned to leave in May, but the BOG abruptly set her departure for the end of January. And that leaves Carolina leaderless in the middle of the biggest fundraising effort in its history. On October 6, 2017, UNC announced the five-year, $4.25 billion campaign for Carolina to help recruit top students and hire and retain the best faculty. Unspoken but understood was the school has faced a challenge getting consistent public funding and that the skyrocketing cost of living in Chapel Hill has had an impact on faculty and staff. Carolina's effort was announced only months after Duke University concluded its seven-year, $3.85 billion Duke Forward. Folt has been a key driver in the effort, and the changes in South Building had UNC scrambling. On January 17, David Routh, the vice chancellor for university development, sent a lengthy note urging supporters to remain faithful. He praised Folt for her passion for the school and noted that the campaign is exceeding our expectations and has raised $2.4 billion so far. If we continue to attract the very best students and world-class faculty, Carolina will continue to lead the way as one of the most innovative universities in the world, Routh wrote. Thanks to the innovative work being done across this campus, I believe the best is yet to come. Local banker enters retirement with Angus Barn event, Sweet Rolex. For Bob Hatley, founder of Paragon Bank, this may have been a long journey but a fruitful one. After selling the bank to Town Bank for about $324 million, stock deal, Hatley's formal retirement party at the Angus Barn Pavilion on January 18 ushered in many of the business who's who's, including former Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina CEO Brad Wilson, luxury home builder Rex Bost, Charlotte attorney Susan Branch, Appalachian State University Athletics Director Doug Gillen, and Angus Barn owner Van Uhr, among many others. Hatley, with his family present, delivered a passionate speech about how he started the bank from his kitchen with two employees, COO Matthew Davis and Senior Vice President Carol Isaac. Davis is taking over Hatley's slot in Raleigh, and Isaac is retiring. Bob Ashton, Town Bank's executive chairman, made sure Hatley did not leave the party with just a half-lit cigar. Ashton presented him with a Rolex watch after a brief speech about how similar workplace culture eased the integration of Town and Paragon. And not just any Rolex, Hatley received a gold and silver Oyster Perpetual Date Just worth about $13,000. She's now on point for RDU International Airport. Raleigh-Durham International Airport has tapped Crystal Feldman as its new Vice President of Communications, Government, and Community Affairs. It's a role previously held by Christy Van Auken, who left for a position at Research Triangle Foundation. Feldman, whose previous posts include Deputy Secretary for Communications at the North Carolina Department of Transportation, will oversee multiple areas, from media relations to airline services. And the pressure is on, as RDU has been in expansion mode in recent weeks. Already, RDU has announced 18 new nonstop flights in 2019. Local real estate leader takes on big national role. A familiar face from Triangle Real Estate Circles has been pegged to lead the board of directors at NAI Global, a worldwide commercial real estate firm. Jimmy Barnes, president of NAI Caro Atlantic, is the new chairman of the company's 16-person board, overseeing NAI Global's 7,000 real estate professionals and more than 400 offices around the world. Barnes says he's interested in helping expand NAI Global's footprint into new markets. I want to try to continue to broaden our NAI brand throughout the country from a marketing standpoint, he says. That also means connecting disparate offices and increasing the amount of referral business that comes from the larger network. Sometimes that's as simple as getting brokers to ask their clients about their real estate needs elsewhere around the country and connecting them with brokers on the ground. That's how you push business around the country. You ask the question, Barnes says. Iconic North Carolina resort to reopen after hurricane damage. The Blockade Runner Beach Resort, an oceanfront landmark in Wrightsville Beach, will reopen in time for Valentine's weekend, well, sort of, after having to close in September due to the resulting damage inflicted by Hurricane Florence. The resort is opening the tower building containing its largest block of rooms on February 15, a Friday. The remainder of the Blockade Runner will reopen later. The hurricane damage at Blockade Runner is in three categories. The damage to our buildings and property, estimated to be $5 million. Content loss, approximately $2 million. And loss of business during repairs, approximately $2 million, said Bill Baggett of the Baggett family, owners of Blockade Runner. The total loss will be close to $10 million. As you would expect, Blockade Runner was insured. Now we turn to the On Transportation and Banking page written by Lauren Onisorge. Spirit could add even more RDU flights. Should ultra-low-cost carrier Spirit Airlines find success with recently announced flights from Raleigh-Durham International Airport, more could be coming. That's according to John Kirby, Spirit's Vice President of Network Planning. If the new flights debuting this spring are supported, he says, we certainly will look at opportunities. The seven destinations announced by Spirit earlier in January are all routes already served by incumbent airlines at RDU, but Kirby says Spirit may look to add to RDU's destination network with future announcements. That's as, he admits, the airport has seen tremendous growth that complicates exclusivity. A lot of the nonstop destinations that are attractive have been filled, Kirby says. For us, we're really focused on what's best for Spirit, where it makes sense for us to be. We want to continue to grow our gateways, but also offer our guests destinations they want to go to. As for the next announcement, the fall schedule could be complete in the next month or so, he says. We typically load schedules about 5 to 6 months out, Kirby says. We're already looking at the advanced bookings, he says, of the new RDU flights. Big banks face competition from J.P. Morgan Chase. New York banking giant J.P. Morgan Chase is pushing forward with its 400-branch expansion strategy, a move that, according to papers filed with the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, includes new locations in Raleigh and Chapel Hill. On an earnings call this month, CEO Jamie Dimon told analysts that the first 10 branches in its expansion markets, which include Washington, D.C., Boston, and Philadelphia, are open. And although it's clearly early, perception in the market and the performance of the new branches has been strong, Dimon said. The bank has declined to answer specific questions about its plans for the Triangle, but documents filed with the OCC reveal its intentions for two local branches at Raleigh's Midtown East and Chapel Hill's Carolina Square. And history shows its plan is right in line with typical J.P. Morgan strategy. Lee Burrow, CEO of Bank Street Partners, says the retail-oriented bank picks strategic high-profile locations, relying on heavy foot traffic in its lobbies. Based on their target marketing, historically, J.P. Morgan would be competing for business more with Bank of America and Wells Fargo and area credit unions rather than your traditional community banks, he says. Big banks continue to be the largest market shareholder in the Raleigh metropolitan statistical area, per FDIC data. As of June 30, Wells Fargo had nearly 26.6% of the Raleigh market, followed by BB&T at 15.3% and Bank of America at 12.5%. Little margin for error in runway pavement plan. As Raleigh-Durham International Airport continues to work through funding challenges related to its new runway, officials have a more pressing problem: how to keep the current strip operational in the meantime. The new runway is still years away, and without an overhaul, the 10,000-foot strip currently serving transatlantic flights won't last that long. So earlier in January, officials approved work on a bold $12.6 million plan to replace the aging pavement on the current runway slab by slab, all without interrupting a single international flight in the process. Of the two runways, the 10,000-foot strip is the only one long enough to serve the large jets crossing the Atlantic. With that in mind, crews will close the runway for 18 hours a day starting in April. They'll swiftly replace the massive blocks of concrete with new surface, and it will dry in time for American Airlines and Delta Airlines flights to Europe. Bill Sandifer, COO of the Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority, says there's very little margin for error. And finally, in a section called He Said It, the value of bringing IBM and Red Hat together is going to be centered around hybrid, open, multi-cloud, and us wrapping around our security, secure to the core, and how we're going to deliver that differentiated value proposition. And we're just excited about what Red Hat is going to mean to the IBM company and our clients. That's Jim Cavanaugh, IBM's chief financial officer, speaking to analysts on an earnings call January 22 after announcing full-year revenue totaling $79.6 billion. Now we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Ben Graham. Go Triangle seeks partner for tower. Developers can now get in line for the latest opportunity to build a tower in downtown Raleigh. Go Triangle has formally begun its search for a development partner to construct a new mixed-use tower above the Transit Authority's long-planned bus terminal in the Warehouse District. The project would rise above a 1.76-acre parcel at the corner of West Hargett and Southwest Streets, currently home to mostly vacant warehouses and Go Triangle's existing office. The agency released a request for qualifications soliciting development teams on January 23. Details about the size of the tower, its design, and what it might contain remain to be seen. Go Triangle President and CEO Jeff Mann says, "We have no predetermined outcomes in terms of the mix of uses," he says. That said, creating affordable housing is listed as one of Go Triangle's goals for the project. The larger goal of the development project, outside of continuing to develop a multimodal transportation hub in the Warehouse District, is to add density near a future transit center. Bringing in more residents and foot traffic is one of the surest ways to get people out of their cars and increase bus ridership, Go Triangle officials have said. That has already begun to happen in the Warehouse District, which saw the Dillon, which rises 18 stories, open just across the street last year, and the new tower could be big. Current zoning allows for buildings on the property to rise up to 12 stories, but Go Triangle is already seeking a rezoning to allow more development on the site, according to HRNA, a consulting firm hired by Go Triangle to advise on the development process for the bus terminal site, also known as RUS Bus. Developers buy century-old downtown Raleigh building. Boutique development firm Atlas Stark Holdings has taken on its latest project in downtown Raleigh, buying an old upholstery shop with plans to convert the building into office and restaurant space. The firm bought the former Auto Interiors and Tops property at 303 Northwest Street for $2.8 million and has already begun tearing out the indoor fixtures. "We're in there just getting it cleaned up, bringing it back to the bones," says Gabe Gouloy, managing partner at Atlas Stark. The two-year-old company plans to have the shell ready for tenant upfits by June, with a targeted opening date in September. Ideally, Gouloy would like to see the space filled with office users as well as restaurants or bars. The building totals 15,000 square feet and sits on less than half an acre, a block south of the massive mixed-use P Street project being built by Kane Realty Corporation and Williams Realty and Building Company. Atlas Stark's building has operated as an upholstery shop since the early 1960s, Gouloy says. Lenny Garner purchased the property in 1977 and folded it into his business, Auto Interiors and Tops, which he started a few years earlier on Martin Street. The business is still in operation, now located on South Wilmington Street and run by Tommy Gardner, Lenny's son, Gouloy says. The old fireplaces that once served as the structure's only heat source will dot the inside of the building, which was built in 1920, but Gouloy says it burned down in the 1930s. It was remodeled in 1940, according to Wake County real estate records. Student housing on former Velvet Cloak site sells. A new student housing development built on the former site of the Velvet Cloak Inn in Raleigh has sold for $52.74 million. Atlanta-based Peak Campus and capital partner Blue Vista Capital Management closed on a deal for the 150-unit Signature 1505 complex earlier this month, selling it to the Priest Company, according to Wake County records. Built in 1962, the 174-room Velvet Cloak Inn was once a stopover spot for politicians and NC State University alumni before being converted into residential condominiums in the mid-2000s. But after years of neglect and legal maneuvering with former condo owners, the managers of the property began entertaining offers in 2015. Peak Campus and Blue Vista finalized the purchase of the hotel property in 2016 and began demolition a year later. Today, the student housing complex totals nearly 200,000 square feet in addition to a parking deck. The units have enough beds for more than 500 students. The Priest Company is based in Raleigh and is among the largest privately held student housing companies in the country. Durham warehouse doubles value in less than 3 years. A Florida real estate investment partnership has pulled a repeat trick, cashing in big returns on a warehouse complex in Durham after signing Amazon as a tenant. A joint venture between Tampa-based Meridian Development Group and Texas-based Thackeray Partners has sold the sprawling North 70 Distribution Center for $16 million, less than 3 years after purchasing the complex for $7.3 million. Meridian had similar returns on the North 540 Distribution Center in 2016, which it bought 2 years earlier for $8.2 million and then sold for $16 million. To pull off the latest deal, the group landed Amazon as a tenant. After the partnership bought North 70 Distribution Center, the group pumped money into an exterior facelift of the property. At the time of the sale, the 262,000-square-foot warehouse was occupied by a single tenant, West Brothers Transportation Services Incorporated, but the company downsized its space, moving out of 100,000 square feet, providing the new owners with an opportunity to renovate a chunk of the building. Triangle's newest climbing gym coming in Durham. Climbers in Durham and Chapel Hill have been getting their ropes tied in knots in anticipation of the new Triangle Rock Club location set to open in a former Walmart Supercenter on Martin Luther King Jr. Parkway. When complete, the facility will total just over 27,000 square feet, making it the biggest climbing gym in the state, according to the company. That's slightly bigger than the Triangle Rock Club's current Mooresville location. The tentative opening date for the first phase of the project is set for this summer. "We're expecting high demand for this location given the amount of interest we've received so far," Triangle Rock Club managing partner Joel Graybeal said in a statement. Now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Life Sciences and Education page, written by Seth Thomas Gullidge. Wolfpack Ice Cream heads for stores. For the first time in the long, milky history of NC State University, Triangle residents will be able to buy the university's dairy products outside its campus. The university, long known for its animal sciences and agricultural research, has signed a licensing agreement with Harris Teeter for the rights to sell the university's Howling Cow ice cream. Gary Cartwright, NC State's Dairy Enterprise System Director, says funding from the agreement will support programs and scholarships in their programs. He says the exact impact the agreement will have on the program all depends on the brand's success and royalties. "We have no idea of the scope and scale of what this will return," he says. Howling Cow has been around for a long time, though it was originally just called NC State University Ice Cream. The university has been producing dairy products for the last century. Last year was the 100-year anniversary of milk being pasteurized in North Carolina in the basement of NC State's Patterson Hall in 1918. In the 1940s, the university opened its first dairy production facility and began distributing its products, with students shoveling ice into trucks to carry milk across its campus and to state facilities, hospitals, and prisons. The facility and program has been self-supporting since, but because of state regulation, the university was not allowed to sell to the general public. They received an exemption in 2005 to distribute and sell products from their campus. Cartwright says once they began marketing to the public and selling at the NC State Fair, they realized it needed a memorable brand. "We were aware we needed to market ourselves differently, so we created the moniker Howling Cow," he says. Some of the faculty said we should call it Howling Wolf, but we know it's difficult to milk a wolf. Cartwright says the students just absolutely embrace it, with the upswing of demand for local foods and products and the fact that the milk was coming from our farm on Lake Wheeler. It really caught on. New method might blunt impact of hurricanes. Hurricane force winds have torn at North Carolina's coast for years, but one NC State University professor believes his new building method could lead to more wind-resistant structures. Associate Professor George Elvin of the College of Design says his approach is a mix of existing methods: pole construction, laminated lumber, balloon framing, and light wood stud framing, optimized for structural strength. He says his method avoids extensive specialization requirements. In some ways, it's the best of both worlds because it's closer to what we're doing now, Elvin says, and we know what we're doing right now isn't working very well. Compared to other hurricane-resistant options, mostly involving steel and concrete, his method uses large lumber and aims to be less expensive. Material costs are not substantially more than traditional framing, he says, though labor will cost more due to the time involved in the construction. At present, Elvin's model has been tested at scale with success. He says he is currently working to put it through full-size testing. If that succeeds, he hopes to have the method rolled out within a year. Transenterix expects to expand after getting nod from FDA. With another approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration adding more tools to its Senhance surgical system, CEO Todd Pope says Transenterix expects more sales in the coming quarter. The Morrisville-based company announced recently the FDA approval of its Senhance ultrasonic instrument system, another tool to augment its Senhance robotic-assisted surgery platform. The news comes from a steady line of announcements for the system, with the 3 and 5 millimeter Senhance instruments being approved in October. Those allow for microlaparoscopic procedures that are virtually scarless for patients. The ultrasonic instrument system and energy device further advances the system's minimally invasive surgery toolbox. The instruments deliver controlled energy to effectively join and divide tissue and minimize thermal injury to surrounding structures. TrialCard acquires privately held Raleigh firm. Continuing its aggressive growth strategy, a Morrisville company has acquired a Raleigh medical technology firm. TrialCard Incorporated, a pharmaceutical-focused technology company founded in 2000, has announced the acquisition of RX Solutions. RX Solutions, a privately held company of 20 years, provides pharmaceutical copay programs as well as a streamlined program for pharmaceutical companies conducting clinical trials. RX Solutions is a great fit for TrialCard due to its affordability programs, long-standing presence in this space, and commitment to the patient, says Mark Bork, president and CEO of TrialCard. Exelair Partners sold TrialCard to Odyssey Investment Partners in November 2017, with Pitchfork Data estimating its value at the time at $400 million. The company reported about 600 employees halfway through 2018, with an intention to nearly double its Morrisville workforce by another 500 employees. The company recently said it employs nearly 1,500 after onboarding over 840 new employees in 2018. And finally, in a section called He Said It, I haven't found many clients who are excited about assigning their employees to just one healthcare system. When you start to limit that choice, it almost feels like you're driving me someplace that I'm not going to get the care that I need. And that's just a fear that a lot of employees have. And that's from Skip Woody, Area Executive Vice President of Health and Welfare Consulting at Hill, Chesson & Woody at Triangle Business Journal's Healthcare 2020. Now we turn to a Better World page inside the Triangle's nonprofit scene, with first a column written by Jennifer Toll Whiteside, who is the President and CEO of the North Carolina Community Foundation. The headline, Nonprofits Need Boards with Genuine Commitment. Are you serving on the board of a nonprofit organization? Have you been approached about considering the opportunity to serve? Is serving on a nonprofit board part of your professional or personal goals? Wherever you're coming from, board service is a serious undertaking that comes with distinct responsibility. Here are 10 things to keep in mind. 1. Serve on a board for a nonprofit with a mission and work that aligns with your values. You should genuinely care about the organization, not just adding something to your resume. 2. Have a clear understanding of the expectations of serving on the board. If the organization doesn't have a job description for board members, ask for specific expectations. Make sure there is an orientation provided for new members. 3. Be ready to learn as much as you can, ask questions, and most importantly, show up. Attendance and participation at board meetings and events is pivotal. When members miss a meeting or don't attend an event, it affects progress and morale. 4. contribute financially to the organization. You should be giving to the organization at a level that is significant for you. Don't wait to be asked to give. Any organization you serve should be at the top of your giving list. Donating your time is important, but financial support is mandatory. A meaningful financial contribution or contributions from you personally or your place of work demonstrates your support of the organization and your strong belief in the work. 5. Actively participate in asking for financial support for the organization. If you believe in the compelling work of the organization, it's easy to do. Remember that you are asking for support on behalf of the community or cause, not yourself. Your role is to work with the nonprofit staff and board to see how you can be most helpful in making the case. 6. Stay focused on the big picture. Envision where the organization is going and how the mission is being advanced without getting bogged down in details. Understand the role of the staff and the board. Board members should ask and answer questions about where the organization is going, while the staff should figure out how. 7. Know why you are passionate about the organization and be able to articulate it clearly. By joining the board, you become a public face of the organization and should always be prepared to say why you are involved. 8. Do your homework. Review materials prior to the meeting. Just like you would never make an important decision in your business, in your own business, without adequate information, stay on top of materials and information provided. 9. Support the executive director or CEO. It can be a lonely job, and words of appreciation, support, and respect for the work they do goes a long way. Ensure your relationship is open, honest, and respectful. 10. Support and encourage diversity and inclusion. A diversity of backgrounds helps the board enrich its vision of the nonprofit's potential and expands its networks of support. At its best, board members serve as effective ambassadors when they can speak about the organization and clearly communicate with both passion and knowledge about the mission and the work of the organization. Supporting a nonprofit is a great way to recommit to keeping our community strong. And in nonprofit notes, Step Up celebrates 30 years with Raleigh Gala. A crowd of more than 300 is expected January 26 when Step Up Ministry in Raleigh celebrates its 30th year with an event at the Park Alumni Center on the NC State University campus. Two Step Up graduates, Carissa Newkirk and James Ivy, are scheduled to share their story. Founded by White Memorial Presbyterian Church as an outreach ministry in 1989, Step Up helps provide employment and life skills for adults, children, and teenagers. The organization has grown to serve more than 600 citizens of Wake County and the surrounding area annually. First National Bank is the presenting sponsor of the gala. Jay Rissinger, Senior Vice President of FNB, said, "This year, we have invested our resources and volunteer time in Step Up, which is making a real and tangible difference in Raleigh." Step Up has also attracted significant support from the Leon Levine Foundation of Charlotte and Sharpview Capital. Cougar gets new home at Carolina Tiger Rescue. A lost cougar in Washington State has found a new home in North Carolina. Carolina Tiger Rescue, a sanctuary in Pittsburgh, has secured its newest furry resident, a less-than-one-year-old cougar, which has yet to be named. The cougar was found in a Washington neighborhood by residents who called authorities. A cooperating wildcat sanctuary in Minnesota and the employees of Carolina Tiger worked to transport the cougar to Pittsburgh. Once permits were secured at both ends of the country, the cougar rode an airplane from Washington to Minnesota. Staff from the Wildcat Sanctuary drove the cat from Minnesota to Indianapolis, where they met a transport vehicle from Carolina Tiger Rescue for the last leg. And now we turn to the Executive Voice column, Q&A column, featuring Carol Folt. And in the closer look box of information, name Carol Folt, age 68, education, B.A., Aquatic Biology, and M.A., Biology, University of California, Santa Barbara, Ph.D., Ecology, University of California, Davis. First academic job, lecturer at UC Davis. The headline for the column, Folt looks ahead as her tenure winds down at UNC. And this is written by Seth Thomas Gulledge. Carol Fault is full of energy, standing in her spacious light blue office with a view of the old well. The chancellor of UNC Chapel Hill says she hasn't used her office chair since staff installed her standing desk. So it's no surprise that with the Silent Sam controversy continuing, Fault decided not to sit still. She announced both her resignation and her decision to remove the rest of the Confederate statue in the same thunderous note, and her tenure was soon shortened by the University of North Carolina Board of Governors. But she leaves with a long list of accomplishments at a school rocked by an athletic scandal when she arrived. She has led prodigious fundraising efforts with the Campaign for Carolina, announced October 6, 2017, having already raised $2.46 billion of its $4.25 billion goal for 5 years. What do you wish you had known when you first began at UNC? Every single job that you take, you bring your past experience to it, but every job is a new step. The most important thing you need to bring in is that same feeling of wonder and excitement with every start of a job. It's a fresh page. When you come in knowing that you're going to take time to learn things, you can't be too impatient. I think that's what I always have to remind myself. I tell people starting, you're not going to start off knowing everything, but that's okay. Enjoy that process of learning because that's what's going to give you the best advantage going forward. But the tendency is to get in there and make it happen, but that's not going to work. Coming from Dartmouth College, how different was it to lead a school as massive as UNC? I understood the size and scale pretty easily. Surprisingly, my budget at Dartmouth and my budget here were about the same. For me, the biggest difference is that at Dartmouth, I knew everybody. I knew the kids. I'm coming to a new place, so I have the wonder of everywhere I go, there's something new and I'm meeting a new person. But you also don't always know where to go to get a piece of information or how to interpret it. Who do you turn to say, what did that really mean, or what's the next step? Those are the issues of the difference in size and scale, but they reveal quickly. What changes do you see ahead for UNC? Everyone always thinks the next 10 years are going to be the most important. We live in our moments, but for higher education, we're in a moment of real transition, and I think it's one of great opportunity. You look at the numbers, and you realize more and more people are wanting to go to school than ever before. We just saw the newest reports come out of the World Economic Forum saying 3 of 5 kids in elementary schools today are going to be in jobs that have not yet been created. You see other numbers that say 1/3 of the jobs in America will be automated in the next 10 to 20 years. Those are all reasons that higher education has to embrace this moment because we're part of the solution for everything: knowledge, flexibility, transition. It's a moment for higher ed to say, are we training people for this new world or are we training people for the world that was? On the flip side, there's less money to do things that we need, but they don't cost less, so we have to be better at managing our money because it's different than it was. For that new world, what should UNC's priorities be? We have a group of business leaders we meet with, and I always ask, what do you want our graduates to do? It's a combination of new hard skills and lasting soft skills, but one of the more interesting things is that nobody thinks that you just need to create a bunch of coders. They think you need to give people the high-tech skills that they need, coding, data analysis, the synthetic skills that have to do with looking at a lot of different things and being able to find what their commonalities are, being able to make very strong, critical decisions, understanding technology so that you're not a victim of technology, but you understand it. All of those, I think, are hard skills, and you learn them. But increasingly, what people are saying is the soft skills are important. Things like communication, writing, verbal communication, and interpretation of culture. When I talk to business leaders, they say, we need those people. It's a world of teamwork. What is something you wish universities got more attention for? Universities like Chapel Hill have two major responsibilities to the state. One of them is the creation of an educated and talented workforce for the future. We're huge in that way. Our other value is in the discovery of creativity. We are one of the great economic engines of our state. If you talk to people across the country, they say in the next 5 to 10 years, it's about innovation and knowledge. Those are what the economies are built around. The fact that you've got a university here that brings in $1 billion, fifth highest in research in the nation, that's also the nation's first public university. There isn't anybody else like that. A personal one for me is arts. I am just a strong believer that through visual and creative arts, you stimulate discovery and creativity in everyone. It's a pretty inexpensive way to open the door to people on all sorts of things, different cultures, the meaning of expression, etc. What's the best piece of advice you ever got? It was from a faculty member at Dartmouth who I came to talk to when we were facing a kind of financial crisis there. I said, I've got a huge budget cut coming. How do I get people to embrace this as opposed to having it be demoralizing? He said, the most important thing is always think like you're driving down a foggy road. Do you look at the street right ahead of you, or do you look as far as you can? He said, no matter what your issue is, focus on right in front of you. Focus on what's out there. If you get everyone to focus on what's most important, those problems go away. Keep that long view is my single thing I have to tell myself. If I try to say, where are we really going? And now we turn to the viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Region's Growth Reflects TBJ's Success in 2018. I have never been big on writing about and covering ourselves, and that includes other newspapers, television stations, and relevant online and specialty publications. When I speak in front of business and general interest groups, I make it a point to mention that media companies covering other media outfits on a regular basis is frankly a waste of time. Our job is to report the news and place that news in context with smart journalism. So writing about the success of your newspaper in 2018 is a departure from what I believe in. But in this case, I think it is necessary because this is another metric that reflects the Raleigh-Durham-Chapel Hill area's meteoric rise to become an economic powerhouse in the nation. Triangle Business Journal was the fastest-growing publication in 2018 among the 40 business journals spread across the country under the American City Business Journals umbrella. In 2018, our paid subscription base grew by 13.67%, a new record for us when compared to the annual growth we have experienced in recent years. Not only that, your newspaper also ranked number one among the 40 properties in number of subscriptions gained during the year, and that's the raw number that competes with some of the largest metros in the country. So how did this happen? While our reporters, researchers, designers, and editors can certainly take credit, I believe this record growth mirrors the region's economic vibrancy as well. Wake County is one of the fastest-growing communities in the nation. From 2013 to 2017, the Raleigh area's gross domestic product grew from $64 billion to $83 billion, a 30% increase. During the same time, North Carolina's GDP grew by 15%, from $471 billion to $540 billion. In size, while Charlotte is bigger, the Queen City's GDP growth was slower than Raleigh's during the same period. Most of our loyal subscribers know that in the past couple of years, TBJ has made a deliberate attempt to move more stories behind the paywall. While some object to this strategy, most of you understand and recognize that good content often is not free. Moreover, the trust between the reader and the author is far more important today than any time in the past, especially in the age of the media being explosively slapped with credibility-draining fake news and biased taglines. To say we do not make mistakes would be a lie. But what is not a lie is that every piece of text, artwork, and video that goes through the editing process is checked thoroughly, and we remain vigilant in trying to find new ways to tell stories to our readers. Maybe that's what our readers like most about TBJ, us having the ability to adapt with the times and feed off the energy that stems from hardworking people in places like Raleigh, Durham, Apex, Cary, Chapel Hill, and in Johnston and Chatham counties, and so many of our neighbors. Our success in 2018 means we did many things right last year. Rest assured, we will build upon that base in 2019. And most importantly, thank you for sticking with us. Now we turn to news from around the state. Florida developer to add luxury condos in Charlotte's Eastover, written by Ashley Fahey. A site in Charlotte's Eastover neighborhood that currently has two-story buildings with townhouses will be redeveloped for a six-story condo building. an entity affiliated with the Ludgert Companies based in Naples, Florida, acquired 14 units on Cherokee Road from individual owners for about $12.2 million, according to Mecklenburg County Real Estate Records. The site on 130, 132, and 138 Cherokee Road, near the intersection of Providence and Cherokee Roads, will be developed with a building containing 38 luxury condos. This will be the first project in Charlotte by Ludgert, a commercial and residential real estate company that counts Premier Sotheby's International Realty among its divisions. Elsewhere in North Carolina, the Ludgert companies developed a gated golf course community, Linville Ridge, in the mountains. Because there were more than a dozen individual owners involved in the Eastover sale, the deal took 20 months to assemble, says Rob Presley, president of Coldwell Banker Commercial, MECA, who represented Ludgert in the transaction. Presley is working with Ludgert on development opportunities in North Carolina, primarily Charlotte, for now. We feel like there's not a whole lot of new product on the luxury side in the area, says Howard Gutman, president of the Ludgert Companies. We want ours to be the most luxurious project in the area, and we think there is a market for it. Eastover is one of the priciest parts of Charlotte, a neighborhood close to downtown and adjacent to Myers Park. Expected price points for the condos will range from $1.6 million to $2 million, while penthouses will range from $2.5 million to $2.7 million, though those prices are subject to change. Greensboro firm changing name, shifting HQ to Charlotte. Greensboro-based International Textile Group is changing its name and moving its headquarters to Charlotte. Elevate Textiles Incorporated is now the parent company of textile brands Burlington, Cone Denim, American and Efford, and Gooderman and Safety Components, according to the company's website, where the rebranding already has taken effect. Though Elevate's headquarters will be in Charlotte, the company says its offices in Greensboro and Mount Holly will remain as divisional headquarters for the respective fabrics and threads brands. It's unclear how many people work at the Greensboro office and how many of them will move to Charlotte. ITG was publicly traded company formed out of assets of Burlington Industries and Cone Mills in 2004 by billionaire Wilbur Ross, now U.S. Secretary of Commerce. Ross sold the business in 2016 to Platinum Equity Group, an investment group founded by billionaire Tom Gores, who took the company private. And we'll go ahead and stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.